rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, hello everyone. This is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Thanks once again for joining us. We are back and it's Monday morning in Paris. We're sat in the lobby of Stephen Jones's hotel. Owen Slott is with me, Chris Jones as well. Nice for Steve to turn up, isn't it, boys?
Sorry, lads. I was knackered last night and I woke up dying to join you, then I fell fast asleep again.
So just to explain this, we all arrived, we said we'd meet at Steve's hotel, Slotty's on his way to the Gare du Nord to get a Eurostar back to the UK, we'd meet here at 10 a.m, we're all sat down in reception, and no getting hold of Steve. We had to send Slotty, the man on reception, up to wake Steve up.
Yeah, he was so excited to go up to see him in his PJs, he couldn't have moved quickly enough.
Oh God, well, desperate.
He said he'd never been up to the Royal Suite before.
I know, well, my room's so big, it took me about 10 minutes to find me in there.
Well, Steve, you're here now, that's the main thing, and we have a brilliant weekend of rugby to look back on in the World Cup quarterfinals. Slotty, I wanted to start with you, because in the paper on Saturday, you had a piece previewing the quarterfinals, and you spoke about all the superlatives that had been used to build up to them and to look ahead to them. Lived up to expectations, didn't they?
I actually think it surpassed expectations. We all knew the draw for the quarterfinals, and everyone could spot a mile off that it was the four top teams. But you know, what were they going to deliver? Would knockout rugby sometimes cautious? Who was going to play the fine margins to win that way? You just didn't know what it was going to deliver. And Saturday night, you go home after Ireland being edged out by the All Blacks, and your head spinning, and you're thinking that's one of the greatest games, the greatest quarterfinal. Again, the superlatives. You're trying to assess where it all fits in, and then halfway through the Sunday game of France and South Africa, people are already declaring, well, that was the best game ever. There's been six tries in half an hour. We're feeling dead and as if we're hungover on a Monday morning, but I still can't quite believe the magnificence of two nights of rugby in the Stade de France.
Quite right. And, you know, it seems so only weeks ago we were bemoaning the fact that rugby had become so boring. It was box kick after box kick. No one counter-attacked from the long kick ahead. It seems like weeks ago. Now with him, rugby's gone mad. I mean, the first half last night, I was sitting next to colleague from the Daily Mail, and it was just magnificent. The first half, we were looking at each other thinking, this is crazy rugby, it's great rugby. So the face of rugby's changed, the quarterfinals have been magnificent. There's a real pain this morning inside my heart, because I realised after the match how much I wanted France to win this tournament. But Chris, it was just fabulous. Four fabulous games.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the interesting facts about the 10 World Cups is that, five of basically the host unions haven't managed to get through to the final, because, you think, well, you host the tournament, you got a fantastic chance of getting there, but France, twice it's happened now, they haven't managed it at all, to win the World Cup while staging it, so it's no guarantee. And the way that it developed yesterday, look, we went into it knowing there's going to be some kind of car crash because we're going to lose two of the biggest teams in the world. The actuality, it's really hard to defend a situation in which that happens, because those teams put together, those four teams we just watched in the Parc des Princes, put together matches that could have been a final.
It's also an element of the weekend, and maybe we'll touch on this when we get into the games as well, of a weekend of heartbreak and the contrast between the scenes we saw at the end, and also probably retirements when we look at Johnny Sexton. I'm sure we'll come on to him, and Dan Bigger, Antoine Dupont yesterday I saw just on the big screens, just sort of hugging his family at full time, just couldn't believe it. Cameron Wockey went to his knees. It's a fascinating thing. We have such drama and yet kind of very real contrasting emotions at the end of it.
We're kind of a bit used to seeing at the end of big knockout games those images of players falling to the ground and that sort of far off stare, and that's I think almost a familiar picture. But the last two nights that it kind of felt bigger or it had more importance. It carried more significance than that for sort of reasons that we're touching on. That Ireland team and that France team were two of the great European teams, and it's such a dull thing to say, but they deserved to go further than the quarter finalists, because Chris said that they were both worthy finalists.
They were, and I think, look, there's no point in saying that, oh God, what do they do with it? You know, the draw was a complete farce. I just hope that the person who did it has resigned. But also, it was always going to be this, as you say, Slotty. But I think those of us, we're none of us are French, but we have lived with the French for 5 weeks or whatever it is, and we've seen all their aspirations, we've seen their greatness as a team, and I will say here and now, I still think that they're the better. Could have been the better team. In fact, were the better team, and I think they were unfortunate. But it is just a almost like a hammer blow to wake up this morning to see that these marvellous French players are no longer in it.
There's a real brutality, isn't it, about the whole thing? Because, you know, it was brutal rugby. It was rugby at its best. But the aftermath, and we've had this morning some more players in the French team announcing they're retiring, you know, Antonio and Teofino. They're going. This four-year cycle brings... Yeah, players to the point where they've given so much and to get to this stage, and then to suffer, you know, the massive disappointment that awful vision of players falling to the ground to their knees, both Irish and French, knowing that they're never going to get this chance again, and it's been taken away. And unfortunately, these last two matches have raised the question again about the influence of refereeing. And, you know, even down in Marseille, we've had the Fijians talking again about unconscious bias. For a period, I thought, because there were some fantastic referees going on, most of them English, doing great games, I thought we'd avoid this sort of thing. But DuPont raised it again last night, Slotty, didn't he?
Yeah, DuPont said he didn't think the level of the refereeing was up to met the level of the game.
Is that unfair? It was interesting. We always knew at some point that officiating was going to be a big discussion at this World Cup, and we were all at the Paris Games over the weekend. And actually, my big takeaway from both of them was, whilst there are some big calls and there's some marginal calls that you're always going to get at this stage, I thought the officiating was really good.
I did put it this way,
I don't know if officiating is the story after this weekend, after what we've seen and the brilliance we've seen. I struggle to buy into that. I like your line there.
I don't want the officiating to be the story. I'm still wondering about Eben Etzebeth's knockdown, whether it went backwards or not, or why did the referee not review it? But at the same time, refereeing discussions, they're so hard to have properly, because every match has 1,000 decisions in them, and some are wrong and some are right, and whether you think the referee called the big ones right or wrong, I mean, it's such a bitter. I mean, Steve, you got a much stronger view on this than
I did a piece in the paper at the start of the tournament, or after 2 or 3 weeks, saying the refereeing would be fantastic. It has now fallen off a cliff.
You think?
It's fell off a cliff.
Scrums
in the Irish game, breakdown yesterday, really, really poor. There were green jerseys hanging around on the floor after every tackle. The fact that...
Which green jerseys? South African or Irish?
Both. But, I mean, South African. Faf de Klerk, after a shocking bit of play, threw the ball deliberately to try and win a penalty. That was a card all over. That is a yellow card. I'm afraid that Ben O'Keefe, who was so good in the first game of the tournament, was absolutely not on his game yesterday. And I think it'll cost him, or at least it would have cost him the final had New Zealand not been in it.
It really was a car crash, wasn't it, the breakdown? You know, Ireland were always going to do that anyway, because that's how they caused their mayhem. But they came up against a brick wall themselves. I thought that the South Africans really took it to the French in that breakdown there. And Quagga-Smith, you know, pulled off a very, very big turnover. And Nigel Owens has talked about, well, the offence isn't the fact that You know, the hand was on the floor. It's whether you're supporting your body weight, and you know,
which he wasn't.
Exactly. So yeah, these are really split second decisions. Yes, we accept that it's terribly difficult for the refereeing, but that I just thought that it got away from Ben. I thought going into the match he was really on good form. I thought, but that match I thought no, that wasn't.
Alfie, what you brought up, we're getting away from the magnificence of the games, which they were. So, yeah. But you know, it just leaves a sour taste. But It's a difficult game to referee. I don't mind saying that. Yeah. I hope Wayne Barnes does the final.
Yeah, Steve Baldwin and says also, he won't be doing it because England will be there.
Well, we can get onto that fairly shortly.
Also, I also say this, that the South Africans are a bunch of twisters. The explanation they gave for the continual coming on and off of HIA, they were actually resting players, and that should have been stamped down on by the fifth and sixth officials as well. There's no way they were doing HIA. They were just calling people off for a rest.
Well, lots to get into on the pod. I think I probably maybe in the minority here. I get the impression in terms of the officiating. I think it probably comes back to what I said before, in that I feel like that's not the story, but maybe it will come up again, and maybe lots of people listening will also be agreeing with you guys. So the semi-finals are, just to round it off, New Zealand versus Argentina on Friday, and then South Africa against England on Saturday. So in terms of today's podcast, we're actually splitting responsibilities. So us four here are going to look back on the quarterfinals in Paris. Those are the matches we were at, as Ireland were heartbroken by the All Blacks. And then, as we've just mentioned, South Africa silenced the French last night as we're recording this. And then we're going to hear from Alex Lowe and Will Kelleher, who are going to review the action in Marseille. They watch Wales fall to defeat to Argentina.
Who are Alex Lowe and Will Keller?
But I know, I feel like we haven't spoken to them in person for a while on the pod, because our paths haven't crossed paths, but
no.
we'll be hearing from them in Marseille, and obviously Wales game, as I say, and also England scraping past Fiji, and we'll name our god or goddess of the week. But up next, we'll get more into those Paris quarterfinals. Okay, so into the quarterfinals that we watched, as we've referenced already, two brilliant games. I don't know if there has been two test matches back-to-back at the same venue of such quality. It's been really interesting, actually, the Will Kelleher's How to Win the World Cup series, which listeners can get from their podcast feed, which is finished now, where he's spoken to a member of every single World Cup winning team. When he spoke to Comrade Smith for the 2011-2015 All Blacks, he was really interesting on how the All Blacks had to identify that World Cups were different. They obviously always had great teams going into tournaments, and they always came up short. And they had to identify that when it comes to a World Cup, there's something different about it. I just wonder whether that is part of the lesson for both Ireland and France as we reflect upon that. A brilliant four-year cycle, but when it comes to the World Cup, when it comes to the knockout, there's just something different that you need to have.
I think it's really interesting that Ireland and France both won their massive group pool games, and that New Zealand and South Africa were both defeated in their pool games. But when you got to knockout rugby, it was reversed. It was the other way around. They were both so close that you're looking for reasons why. You know, what was the difference? And as mentioned already, one tiny refereeing call on either night would have given you a different winner. So does that mean that New Zealand and South Africa, because they're more experienced knockout teams, had the nous and the game experience to get them over the line? Well, you could say so, but again, we go back to this thing. There were 5 points over two games that separated four teams. I mean, how can you apportion a team's approach to a game when they're separated by such small margins?
I totally agree with that, but I also think that let's look at the other great thing in rugby, Lions test matches. It was quite rare for any team on Lions tours to win two matches in succession, because when you lose, a sort of desperation comes in. It forces you to examine yourself and to examine your tactics. Now, there's one team that's always been ahead of people in that regard, and that's New Zealand. New Zealand have not been a great side, but they did a spectacular number on Ireland, because they when they came out, they knew exactly what they had to do. For instance, they knew that James Lowe was going to kick Miles, and they had plans for it. It was one of the great comeback wins after a defeat in planning precisely what you had to do and executing it beautifully.
Yeah, I thought that New Zealand were very clever in the way that they set up their short kicks rather than the long kicks. They didn't give Ireland exactly the ability to counter it in the way that I thought they probably expected to. And they were just what you'd expect from a good New Zealand side. And they haven't been a good New Zealand side probably since that win in South Africa. That they recognise on the pitch. And they also had two or three key players like Ardie Surveyor who were just having the games of their lives. And just when there was a mistake, you know, he was playing fullback, he was playing scrum half, he was playing every position but back row, which is what he's meant to be doing, because he understood what his role was in that game. And he was such a focal point. And I look at that Irish side and I think, you know, when you wanted them to produce a really big performance from somebody who could drag them forward, it just, at that key, those key moments, it wasn't there. Where New Zealand did have those guys. That Richie Moonga break was absolutely superb. He spotted a gap between Van der Flier and Sheehan, and next minute he's 50 metres downfield. These are fantastic moments that teams with real game breakers have, and I thought the game breakers for Ireland didn't quite do it. I didn't see enough from Ringrose. Well,
the fascinating thing about Ireland is what was the reason that they've been having 8 or 9 or 10 out of 10 performances over the entire year, and then you get to their knockout game, the biggest game of their 4 years, and they're just half a notch down. Was it the stage, the pressure, that how big it was, or was it that they just finally hit a wall, or did the All Blacks do that to them?
Well, they were just outthought, sorry, by the All Blacks.
And that leads us on to the whole Ireland quarterfinal not getting past that. I feel like Ireland losing in this quarterfinal has nothing to do with any sort of mental block or hurdle and not being able to get that past that stage of a competition. I think it simply comes down to they came up against an All Blacks team that produced their best performances, as you said, Chris, for years, and maybe Ireland was not quite at the levels we've seen. They were maybe slightly off it, and in these sort of games, that's enough that means you end up losing.
Also, I think that there was one critical thing, that is they had a 38-year-old fly half who looked all every one of his years. Now, when you're cruising through other games, Johnny Sexton is still a considerable player in many areas. When you've got a 37 phase move and you don't look like scoring once in the key moments of a game, 37 phases, they didn't score because Johnny Sexton has completely lost his pace, and they had to bring on the reserve fly half, Crowley, just to give some edge to it, because you could only move at the pace of your fly half.
And he was standing still at one point, and
he was just sort of shuttling left, shuttling right. What did the All Black coach call it? Cut and paste rugby. And I'm afraid that they didn't have the guts or the bottle to take off Johnny Sexton, probably after an hour, and let the rest of them run.
That would have been a massive call, wouldn't it? Because it was billed, you know, this is Johnny's last hurrah. He was going to lead him to World Cup glory. And yet, to be the coach then takes him off with 20 to go. But those are the big calls. South Africa took their captain off after 44 minutes.
Yeah, that's what he's paid for, though. That's what the coach is paid for.
Well, it brings us on to Johnny Sexton, though. I mean, despite the disappointment, and blimey, there were tears in his eyes at the press conference, in his post-match interviews, a sensational career, which I think people are starting to reflect on once the disappointment of the quarterfinal loss kind of fades away.
Well, he's been Mr. Ireland, isn't he? And yeah, will they live? Is there life after Johnny Sexton? There certainly is. Talking to colleague David Walshon, he's very upbeat about the youngsters coming through.
Absolutely.
And now it will be a case of bringing in those key elements to add to what's already there, because they haven't suddenly become a broken flush. They are a good team. They will come again. They'll come again in the Six Nations by just adding a few new young players to this team.
I don't think they'll miss a beat. I think they'll carry. I'm with Steve. I think Sexton's been brilliant, but he finally looked his age. It was going to happen at some point. There's so many good players around them, but on Johnny, you know, he has been one of the all-time greats, and And to make it worse for everyone, he's now officially the best dad in the world as well. I mean, there's no yeah. room for any of us to go.
Well, we are the best contenders as well.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, best I forgot dads. To say. He's just yeah. edged ahead of Steve Jones as dad of the century.
Do you know what? I've got tickets for the semi-finals. It cost me a fortune for my kids. So, I mean, you know, I think Johnny's second.
Well, he gets his tickets for free, so I think that's one against
well,
him.
I didn't. Yeah. Yeah, Alfie, I think we should remember the at a time when the Six Nations has not been great, how much Ireland have elevated it, how much they took down the All Blacks. What's it four times in the generation? So they've really, really elevated rugby. It's been the best Irish team I've ever seen, and I hope they do recover, and France too, actually.
Yeah, and I agree with what you guys have said in terms of you feel like the systems, the pathways, the structure, the coaching team is kind of in place still for Ireland to be successful going
yeah,
forward.
True.
I'm in the view of sort of looking at the age profile of these teams. So I looked at England when they came up short in the final 4 years ago, thinking, well, they should win it in 4 years' time. But that's another subject altogether. Mm. But you look at the French team and you go, well, hang on, they're going to be better next year. Sorry, in 4 years' time, and I think the Ireland team possibly well, not quite so sure because there are obviously key elements. But those teams, you know, we go. That's the end. They've hit the wall. That's the end of the year or an era or whatever. But I just think they could and should be better.
Mm. One team that will be better in 4 years' time is Fiji, because they would have had another couple of years, 3 years of Super Rugby. For the Drua, who provide 18 players for this squad, and they are going to hopefully be given more international rugby. You never know. World rugby might actually break the cycle. But yeah, if you do give these teams international experience, then they can win the sort of games that Fiji should be winning. And, Ireland have got that in spades because the Leinster Academy is just producing so many fantastic players that Andy Farrell he can look forward to a fantastic period ahead.
Let's finish off with the All Blacks Ireland game on a few words for New Zealand. We mentioned him already, but Ardy Surveyor in the mix zone after the game, which just a little kind of behind the curtain for the listeners, was an absolute scrum with everyone trying to get quotes from the players. I was somehow managed to be kind of there at the front, and then over my shoulder I heard a question. It came from Owen Slot to Ardy Surveyor asking if it was his best ever performance. Slotty, it was hard work trying to get some decent content in that moment, but Ardy Surveyor was sensational against Ireland.
Yeah, he was. He was hilarious. I mean, it was hilarious because it was like a Superman performance. I mean, Chris has already said, you know, he was 1 minute he was box kicking from scrum half, and then he was touching down artistically like a winger, and plus, you know, his breakdown work and his carrying work was, yeah. I mean, I kind of had Sam Kane as my player of the weekend, which is
Surveyor was
bonkersly good.
He was ridiculous, wasn't he?
Sam Kane's performance was tremendous, but Ardy Surveyor, when the All Blacks have been average, Ardy hasn't been. He's been carrying that pack,
yeah,
game after game after game. It was very nice of Sam Kane to actually produce his best performance. But then, if you ask what are the top five performances by Sam Kane, Steve, I think you struggle to get the other four, wouldn't you?
Don't forget, Ardy was the only All Black who played played properly in 2019 in Tokyo. So yeah, he did really well. He's a figurehead. He's a great guy. But I just think that if I had my hero, it would be Ian Foster because of the way that they laid out the tactical plan, but Ardy carried it through to the letter.
That's, you know, one of the aspects of this is which is so fascinating about this World Cup is that Ian Foster is a dead man walking in terms of his job, because Robertson's waiting to take over. And Ian, it's been under the most incredible pressure to deliver an All Black team at a World Cup that's doing well, while knowing they don't want him anymore. I mean, Steve Borthwick's had pressure, but no one's had pressure like Foster coming into a tournament. When you're finished,
how much was it Ian Foster's tactical plan, and how much Joe Schmidt? We can't ever know, obviously.
We won't know. I suspect you're making a good point, Slotty. You're inferring that actually it was Joe Smith's victory and Foster had nothing to do with it, and he sat in his room.
So New Zealand set themselves up then a semi-final against Argentina. We'll be hearing shortly from Alex and Will on Argentina's victory over Wales. Let's have a little chat about the Springboks and then beating the French. I mean, it's one of those games that Slotty and Chris, when we were sat here chatting about it, you try and go back through and remember all the tiny moments that now look so pivotal. I mean, the Cheslin Colby charge down is probably one massive moment we can speak about. And Chris, you were saying actually that you asked him about that after the game.
Yeah, I asked Cheslin how many times he charged down kicks, and he said, "I've never charged one down before." And what a time to do it. I mean, we all know he's quick. But as he pointed out, he played for 6 years with Thomas Ramos. He knows the way that Thomas prepares for kicking. And he said he was behind the line, and when he set off, he was legal. And it was, yeah, he didn't even have to get off the ground where he was so close to Thomas when he blocked the kick. It was, you know, that it was during that sort of period where so much was going on. The match was on fast forward. There was just so much going on. You had to slow it down to remember what had happened.
There's no question that that before the game they knew that there was a chance of that, because I've seen kicks charged down by tall forwards rushing out from underneath the posts for short range. I've never seen anyone charge a kick down like that. I tried to rack my brains, and they must have known from Ramos that he does have a slow run-up, and it was absolutely magnificent a play. And then the guy scored soon afterwards, or was it just before? And, so what a contribution he made, and that's just shattering for the kicker. I mean, he hardly got the ball off. It kicked the ball into his body.
Well, if he'd been 1 second earlier, he could have actually picked the ball up from the tee and walked around him, couldn't he? He was that quick.
Dropped a goal, yeah. Yeah.
It was a fun, interesting game as well, in that particularly look at that first half and the six tries we had in that first half. It was almost a not kind of a typical Springbok performance. I thought it was quite a good example of how they have tried to develop and adapt their game, certainly since the Lions tour, when you think about the style of rugby that you guys all had to sit through on that, to where they are now. And I thought that really sort of came to fruition for them last night, because they've made sure that they've developed their attack.
It did. It was interesting, because I don't think in the end they could make up their mind what to do, because for the first half they had Damien Willems at the fullback. They had their new fly half and a kind of new style, and they did play some good rugby. Second half, they got rid of all that lot and brought on the old guard and played old guard rugby. I think that was how they did it. And I don't think they actually really knew what they were doing. I mean, to take your captain off and four others at half time or near half time, I just think it was a gamble.
It was the old guard rugby that won it, though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
It was bringing on the subs and playing the old guard way, well, if you like.
And I tell you what, the new guard, they were quite good, but they had absolutely enormous assistance from France's miserable performances under the high ball. They were absolutely terrible. These days, people practice jumping in the air, whatnot. People like Wockey and one or two others, they just could not catch the high ball.
Well, it was all identified and planned, wasn't it? It was all directed at the left wing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, just like the All Blacks, they'd done their homework.
Oh, yeah, completely.
They identified the left wing was the smallest guy out there. They stood Peter Steff to toit out there at times so that he was going to have a massive height advantage. And then once they got those opportunities, they were clinical. Lovely little grubber kicks, because, you know, if you've got someone like Colby on the wing or Adens on the other side, these guys are so rapid that even Penno looked slow compared to Colby when he was chasing him. You know, and that sort of clinical edge is great to see. I mean, if you're talking about you bringing on the old guard, why did they bring back Andre Pollard? Can't work that out. Let's have a penalty on the halfway line to win the match. Pollard nails it. I mean, that's why they didn't bring another hooker in.
It's worth remembering as well, and I know what you're saying, Steve, in that, again, France, similarly to Ireland, will look at things and think, oh, we didn't play as well as we have done previously. But France hadn't, or they'd lost at home once in 4 years. That was to Scotland, when there was no one there. For the Springboks to come in a World Cup and beat them, I think does say a lot about how well the Springboks played as well. It's probably the only thing that this podcast is rapidly descending into me disagreeing with all your points. But I think it's just worth saying that it was also a very, very good Springbok performance.
They don't excite me. They don't make me warm to them.
Is that a hangover from the Lions tour, do you think? Because I think their game is very different now.
I think their game, they would like to think, is different. They've got some what they used to call transformation players in there who are very good. But I don't think they have yet brought themselves to let them loose. Mm. It's as simple as that.
They were a Jekyll and Hyde team, weren't they, in their selection, because they picked running halfbacks, and then on the bench they had two of the great kicking tacticians who can get you into places where the opposition don't want you to be. And you know, and I think they were quite in love with that idea. I don't think they made the best of either. I mean, Libok, everybody said about his kicking, he nailed it from the wrong side on the touchline conversion. Now, that must have given him a massive lift. Yeah. Yeah. And then sort of 44 minutes into the match, thank you and good night. And they took off the captain and all the and the halfbacks. It was a massive call. I mean, obviously it was predetermined, but it wasn't exactly they had a feel of the game to take them off at that stage.
They always, as you say, it was largely predetermined. I mean, having gone 7-1 and 6-2 benches for the World Cup to then change it to 5-3 and leave off Faf. It was clear that they were going to try and play a more try scoring game for the start of the game and then tighten up and go traditional Boca rugby for the end of it.
No, I agree.
Interesting. So the Springboks, they set up a semi-final against England, who beat Fiji in Marseille. And up next, we'll head to the south of France. We're here from Will Kelleher and Alex Lowe, who watched that game. They also watched Wales lose to Argentina. So over to Will and Alex.
Hi, Alfie. Alex and Will here, down in Marseille, still sort of trying to get our heads around this epic quarterfinal weekend of the World Cup. We're heading up to Paris shortly, but thought we'd sit down and ruck before we hit the train. Yeah. Will, what a weekend.
Oh, it was amazing, wasn't it? I think we spoke last week about feeling like the World Cup was happening in other places, and we were watching both the Paris games that the lads are talking about and saying it might look like a different sport up there, but at least we got some amazing games down our end, didn't we? I mean, wow. I don't know where to start. Should we start with the Wales-Argentina? Because I suppose.
I think we'd always said that the difference in quality would be obvious between the Paris quarterfinals and the Marseille quarterfinals, but they were always going to be evenly balanced. But I'm not sure anyone would have expected all four games to go down to the last minute, like the last play of the last minute almost. The game was on the line right to the death in all four games, and that's just quality drama, quality entertainment. The tension that we had at the Stade Velodrome for Wales Argentina followed by England was right up there, and that makes a great game. The quality wasn't as good as the lads saw up in Paris, two of the greatest international games you'll ever see, but you can't ask for more than two evenly matched contests that go to the wire.
I love some of our job is to bring the colour of the days that we're at, and we're so lucky to do what we do, and I just absolutely adored that Saturday where you've got the Welsh fans singing on the trains coming in the metro station into Do Prado metro station. And then it was the same, I think, for the England game, but the Argentinian fans almost, it was like they dropped a pin for each other and said, right, we're all meeting outside this bit of the ground. And if everyone has been over this weekend to the Velodrome, you'll know that there's these huge stairs that go up towards the stadium, which is actually where a lot of the England and Argentinian fans got stuck on the first weekend. But yeah, the Argentinian fans, they were all in their 07 rugby shirts or their Mascherano or Messi or Maradona football shirts. And they all do this thing. And I've found it hard to describe when you can't see what I'm doing, but it's this flinging hand thing that they all do. And they have this chant that they sang at the football when they won the World Cup and jump around.
Oh, it's wicked.
And they were doing that from 2.5 hours before kickoff. And just, I love the colour of it as well. You've got the red shirts against the white and blue, and it was brilliant. We used to Welsh fans not being outsung around the world, but the Argentinians beat them hands down, didn't they? And then we had the game where Wales should have won.
Well,
they
should have won.
17-0, it should have been half time at least.
Yeah. So they're 10-0 up, and they're on top, and just where our seats were, slightly around the 22 for this game, and Wales down in front of us had three lineouts in the Argentinian red zone and couldn't complete any of them. They had a couple of line breaks, Dan Bigger's line break, and then Gareth Davis can't quite hold on to the pass.
Then there was George North going down the right wing and flinging a pass inside to Josh Adams
for his shoulder.
When you first saw that, you thought, oh my God, how's he dropped that? But then you look again and it was a bad pass.
He fizzed it too hard. Yeah. And so you're like, they've got five chances there. And Argentina were threatening at moments, flashes, I guess a little bit like Fiji did to England through the first half. There was always an underlying danger that they could score, but they weren't building pressure. Wales built pressure and then they couldn't convert it. And you just felt that if they'd gone to 17-0, like you say, if they can take on one of those, then the game's in control and Argentina really have to chase. And we saw the Pumas against England, when England had them in this vice grip, they couldn't get out of it. They lost their composure, really, in that opening game. Now, obviously, we're 6 weeks on from there and teams have changed, but I do think there's a fundamental thing about Argentina that when they're in it, they're on it. But if they feel they're under pressure, they don't quite react in the way they need to. And 17-0 would have been the game for Wales.
You covered Wales a lot in your previous roles, and I've covered Wales too slightly more recently. And I just thought it was a very non-Gatland-y Wales. Mm. Often, when they were at their best under him, they took their chances, fought, stayed in the game, and had one or two chances and took them. And sometimes they weren't the best team on the field, but they won the game. Whereas this was almost the opposite, where they were better than Argentina, and they had chances, but they just bunged a few of them. The lineup wasn't great. Some of their basic stuff let them down. And that's where I think they'll probably all be already at home going, God, that was such a missed opportunity. Like, they could have got through.
Yeah, I got a tweet from someone at half-time who just said, he thought Wales had shot their bolts, as he put it, that was their chance to grip the game, and that was it, that Argentina would come back. And it was a very prescient assessment of the situation, because that is exactly what happened, and Argentina took a grip on it, and then it became this tense finale again, and Wales are chasing, they're trying to force something to happen, and they run a play that had been really successful for them through the first half, the kind of classic loop play, fly half, just pulling the ball out the back.
Costello, yeah.
Costello just didn't quite get the... He did one of those that you often see, and Sexton often does it. He doesn't rip it back, just sort of hangs it in the air for someone to come round and take it off him. And it felt like Costello just hung it in the air behind him, when what was needed was a ripped back pass.
A George North fizzer.
Yeah, and it was really well read from Nicolas Sanchez.
Yeah.
And you talk about the colour of the occasion and the noise when Argentina scored that winning try, and the jumping and the singing and the flinging of the hands, and but there was a great sort of spirit around the stadium. Even afterwards, in the bars and getting on the tube on the metro to go back and watch the evening game from Paris, it was actually a really nice atmosphere. Wales fans were disappointed, but they were in great spirits still. They were almost enjoying the spectacle of the Pumas fans singing, and it's a missed opportunity for Wales, that's what will sting. That's what will sting, because it was there for them to win that game.
And I tweeted about it, because we got the binoculars out, because we're quite high up in the Stade Velodrome, and you just saw... I just love the fact that Argentina slightly lost their heads a bit in having won the game. And I know that others have said, like, I know Matt Dawson on the BBC pod was saying, I don't know what they're doing, wasting their energy doing that, but I kind of just love it. So Emiliano Bulafelli has kicked them into the semi-finals of the World Cup, maybe unexpectedly, and he was shirt off, slapping his chest in the crowd, flinging that shirt round his head for ages. And there's a great picture, if you can find it, I put it on my Twitter account, of him in the crowd doing that. And I just thought, fair enough, like, if these are the moments that you live for, why not celebrate them? Like, it was brilliant, wasn't it?
It couldn't have been more contrasting to the way that England reacted to their win 24 hours later. It was so next job that you just wonder whether Borthwick ever finds any fun in anything. And that's England's mentality, and that's how they're approaching it. I do enjoy, and it's Andy Farrell's approach too.
Which, again,
like, critics will say, well, you know, they celebrated beating South Africa in the pool, but what did that earn them? They're going home. Well, but they enjoyed the day. They achieved something and they enjoyed it and they celebrated it. And I see nothing wrong with that, because if everything is about the next job, then what's the point in doing the job you're doing now?
Yeah. Well, that maybe leads us to a nice segue to England, because they won their quarterfinal, and it was harum scarum, wasn't it? But they got the job done. I mean, privately, quite a few of the players are talking about sort of 07-ing it and doing it hooker by crook.
Hooker by crook, that's the phrase that keeps coming up.
And there was, I mean... Wow. So they're 14 points up, 50-odd minutes, cigars out. I think Nick Randall is our a man in the office was saying they basically had the silver tray out with the cigars on it. And then suddenly, bang, bang, Fiji. I think I remember, I don't know if I said it to you, I was sitting next to you, Alex, but thinking at the time, 40-0 up is possibly not enough. Just, you need to get 17 points ahead, just to make sure that you can't be hit by the thunderbolts that Steve Borthwick described them as.
I felt that, so I was writing the first go of the match report fairly on the whistle. I mean, the way that it finished, you never hit it bang on, but as quickly as we could get it over. So you're writing as you go, and you're trying to assess and analyse the flow of the game as you go. And it was frantic. At the time, it felt like Fiji were only ever one pass away from scoring a try at all times. And so the way that England had to play was to defend with discipline and organisation, which they hadn't done against Fiji in August. And they hadn't done a week earlier against Samoa. They absolutely monstered the breakdown. Ben Earl had his best game for England. He's building up a catalogue of good performances. This was the best. Tom Curry and Courtney Laws. This was just another of Courtney's body on the line, peel him off the turf type performances that you get from Courtney.
Especially after he got completely manhandled into touch by Bill Matter and Frank Lomani, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that was, I think you wrote in your piece, that was akin to the Tindall on Gregan hit in 03. One of those that will probably get replayed. But to be fair, he was then the guy that won the great turnover at the end. He sticks in, doesn't he?
So you're trying to assess it as it goes. And it was easier after the match actually to just reflect back on how England did it. But at the time, you always felt, like you say, that Fiji were one offload away from breaking England. But actually, they never built anything meaningful, Fiji, in that first half. Because England did such a good job of chopping them. Their tackling was low, to the point where at one point...
Almost too low.
Tom Curry was penalised, could have got a yellow for that. But they were chopping them down low. And they walked off blooded and bruised and battered. What that did, by chopping them low and then attacking the breakdown, they denied Fiji any continuity and started to frustrate Fiji. And at the same time, they scored a couple of tries. So I thought when they got 14 ahead, I thought that was critical because it gave them a cushion. It wasn't a match-winning cushion necessarily, and as it proved, but two converted tries ahead was the cushion that they needed. And then, of course, bang, bang, Fiji did build some continuity in attack, which is really easy for them to do. We saw it at Twickenham. All it needs really is for that first offload to stick and then for the second runner to come through an offload to the third and then back, and then they're in behind.
Like the semi-Rajaratna into Botetu.
Exactly. Yeah. And once they piece that together, they're devastating against any team in the world. And they did it twice in 4 minutes, the two thunderbolts, as Borthwick called them. And suddenly you're at 14-all. Sorry, 24-all. They've closed that 14-point gap. And you're like, what do England do now? Mm. Because England lost their heads a bit against Samoa. And it was really the Danny Kerr and a couple of the others at the end. We've seen in the past, and this is going back a number of years, but we've seen days like that when Owen Farrell has not known what to do. Scotland at Twickenham is the most obvious example where the 31 points up, Scotland get on a roll, and England can't cope, and Farrell is losing his rag, frankly. He's certainly losing his composure. England aren't going to get to this World Cup final playing Fijian rugby.
No.
We've always said, and we said it last week, I think, they have their style, and their style is fine. The criticism that's been levelled at them is that they've been doing it scruffily.
Yeah.
I felt they played well against Fiji. They're the only unbeaten team left in the competition.
Which is mad.
They did what they had to do, but they showed a control and a composure when they could have panicked.
Mm.
And I thought that was impressive from them.
So here's where we might need to pull back the curtain slightly. And I know some of this is a bit boring for listeners who aren't in press conferences and all that. But I think it is helpful maybe to try and tell you guys what's happening out here. There was a lot of criticism, I think pretty fairly, for England in the Six Nations and August. They were 50-pointed at home, record defeat home to France, desperate performance. And if they hadn't been criticised then, I don't know when you would criticise them. They then put together, they sort of fought a little bit in Ireland and actually fronted up fairly well. And I think they were given credit for that, even though they lost. Then the August campaign was shambolic. red cards almost every week. They looked unfit, leggy. They've explained that since by the fact that they were training very hard.
Although not everyone in the game buys that.
No, which is a valid point to make. They then have since been very, very annoyed. And I would say that largely this is the head coach, Steve Borthwick. This is less the players. They're trying to almost divorce themselves from some of the things that Borthwick's saying in press conferences, almost while sitting next to him. So they've taken it personally that people like me and Alex and others were critical of them in the summer. And I think it's an interesting dynamic now because Steve Borthwick came into his press conference after they won the quarterfinal of the World Cup against Fiji in a great game. And he couldn't be more downbeat.
Chippy.
And I think that's okay when you're talking to journalists, but I think in those situations, you're not just talking to the media, you're talking to your country and to the fans. And I know he did it on ITV too, where everyone's written us off. There are people around here that never thought we would get out the pool, never thought we'd get through, and here we are. And that's all kind of fine. But I think that it's a little bit much and a little bit unfair on supporters who've paid a lot of money, been promised a lot for a long time about this England team. And I think people just want to now enjoy the ride. And I think trying to score points and creating this siege mentality thing is okay. But I just think it's leaving a sort of sour taste, maybe. And that, like, if he doesn't want to do the media stuff, that's fine. There's plenty of other people we'd like to speak to around the England team who are brilliant to speak to. And there are a lot of the players that spoke very well last night and sort of get that connection between the fans and the country. But I don't know what you thought about it. I just thought it is a little bit cheap, maybe.
I felt that I could see why England and Steve in particular would have used it to get them to this point. They did come in for a lot of criticism. They'd won 3 games out of 9 coming into the World Cup. We're not here to provide blind support. There was no evidence to suggest that they were going to do anything major at this World Cup. Now, you could argue they still haven't, given the teams that they've played. But they've made a World Cup semi-final. And I think if you were to rewind to previous episodes of The Ruck and previous pieces that have been written, the general consensus about England was that they're not very good, but they'll probably make the semi-finals of the World Cup. I've talked to many people in the media and outside that has long been the analysis of what England are likely to do at this World Cup because of the draw. And we all know what the draw is. We don't have to have that conversation again. But I can see why he'd want to develop a siege mentality in order to get them this far. But having won the game, I'm not sure he struck the right tone because they've made the semi-finals and they've got a country behind them. Everyone wants England to win. All England fans want England to win. You know, quite frankly, people read more of what we do when England win. They buy more newspapers. They subscribe more to the Times. We probably get more listeners to The Ruck. You know, we're not here as supporters, but it's a much nicer job to do when England win. Trust me, it's a much nicer job to do. And they now go and play the Springboks. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if they look at what Wales tried to do against the Box 4 years ago in the semi-final, turned it into a
horrible game.
Horrible game. And honestly, if England get to 25 yards from the Springbok line, they should be dropping a goal every single time.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't, like, just go and, you know, South Africa are a dangerous, powerful team. They're also dangerous offensively.
Incredible counter-attackers. Like some of those tries last
Yeah, so there are loads of other areas that will need to be smart and we'll investigate them and look at them through the week. They'll need to be a really intelligent strategy, which Borthwick, that's his forte. He will deliver that.
Yeah.
But I can see the drop goal strategy coming back into play big time.
It's just going to be good fun, isn't it? Like, I've got lots of Celtic friends and lots of who are going, I'm 0-4 from results I wanted from that week.
Yeah, I was only 1-4 in predictions. But yeah.
Shout out, by the way,
John
Westerby. So readers of the Times will know that often we have to do these predictions and they're a bit of hiding to nothing sometimes. And particularly this weekend with some of the most unpredictable, brilliant quarterfinals you've ever seen. And our friend and colleague, John Westerby, got 4-4. I mean, that is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Maybe not exactly the margins, but I don't know if that would have been ridiculous. Rayman, if he'd got there.
John's had a mighty week. 4-4 predictions and a couple of outstanding pieces.
The Bottia piece is lovely. Yeah,
yeah, lovely piece with Lavani Bottia and a piece on the French players and their links to these tiny islands in the South Pacific, which is, although France have gone home a little puncture some of the atmosphere, that's still worth a read. It's a great piece. So shout out to John.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, I think our TGV is leaving fairly soon to get up to Paris to join all the others up in the capital. But should we just give Alfie a quick God or Goddess of the Week or Devil? I'll go first very quickly. You mentioned him before. The boff. We've got to have Buffelli. Absolutely loved it. Shirt off, slapping the chest, in with the Puma fans. Loved it. And he scored loads of points and is brilliant. So he's my god.
I mean, there's so many from up in Paris, but seeing as we're in Marseille, I'll stick with being down here. Can I do a collective England back row? I know Owen Farrell was man of the match, but I just thought...
You're going for the Holy Trinity then, are you?
The Holy Trinity. Holy Trinity. Can they call themselves that, or has that been trademarked by back Delalio and Hill?
Yeah, okay, yeah. They've got a way to
go. I just thought collectively they laid the groundwork for England. And it's so great to see Ben Earl delivering on the potential that's always been there. And when Courtney's in the mood that he was in, and we've seen it times before, it took me straight back to Sydney 2002, one of those performances where he just leads everything. So I'm going to pick them, fully aware that there are lots of heroes up in Paris, but from down in Marseille, those are our two gods of the week.
Awesome. Well, that's been Marseille. We're now Paris for 2 weeks. Whatever happens, there'll be a third, fourth playoff for someone. Who knows? But maybe World Cup final. That would be so. So for the people who criticise England and written them off, they will be ready to make the World Cup final. There you go. That's our dispatch, Elfie from Marseille. But see you all up in Paris pretty soon.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Well, thanks, Will. Thanks, Alex. Good to speak to them, and we'll catch up with them in Paris as they join us up here in the capital for the remaining 2 weekends of the Rugby World Cup. Slotty, Steve, Chris, quick semi-final preview then. New Zealand against Argentina, South Africa against England. After the weekend we've just had of arguably the best quarterfinals we've ever seen, Can anyone see these semi-finals being anything other than an All Black and Springbok victory?
Yeah, but when you say quick semi-final preview, that this is going to be really quick. We know what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, the fact is, you know, the World Cups are littered with inability to produce two good performances in a row. But quite honestly, I'd like to see England actually produce two average performances in a row, because, you know, to play for periods where they do raise their level to win a game against Fiji, who, you know, could have won at the end. Argentina are not the Argentina we expected to be at this World Cup. I can't see anything other than what we expect with New Zealand and South Africa.
Well, first of all, you really hope that Argentina have that passion from somewhere. They did play a little bit better against Wales. Let's hope that England... Look, England is so uninspiring that we do need them to pull up a display. They could get the country back on side just by flogging themselves and making it difficult for the opposition. And there's so many people at home who have not been excited by England rugby for years, so let's wish them the best. I do think that they're one of the teams that's still playing old kick and rush rugby, and they haven't picked up the pace of this World Cup. This is a time for them to do it. This is the time.
I think you're spot on there, Steve, in terms of the excitement was something that...
Is Alfie agrees with me?
I know, yeah. Well, I thought I better at some point.
He's trying to get that red card rescinded.
can I say, I agree with Steve as well. I'm so disappointed with the number of rugby-loving friends and family who've registered their deep antipathy for this England team, and it's just sad, and I'm with Steve. I just England have got a chance now to do something that really lifts hearts and spirits and brightens souls and makes people fall in love with it again. I so hope that, I don't think they will, but it would, they have an opportunity.
It is extraordinary though, isn't it? It was going to be something that I maybe mentioned. I know we've just heard from Alex and Will and they spoke a lot about England, but has a side ever got to a semi-final before a Rugby World Cup and have such little excitement? And it's partly, I think, because of the draw, in that a lot of England fans have looked at it and say, well, England have had a fortunate draw. Yes, they've done what they've needed to do to get to a semi-final, but they don't see them going any further. But I don't, that just that whole feeling around the team does feel strange.
It does, and I think it probably happened before in the early World Cups. I mean, South Africa weren't in it then, so there were just there were a couple of sort of slightly iffy people who got through the semi-final, but nothing like a full-blown World Cup. So look, I think we've Slotty and has covered it perfectly. Come on, boys, just give us a blast for the hour. And Steve Borthwick, don't keep on whittering about it and saying what a great side you've got. Kick them in the backside and get out there and cause bloody havoc.
Well, 2007, you know, England were a shambles, 36-0 against South Africa. And they started doing things in the quarter start. They managed to win the semi-final, got to a final. And you thought, well, how did they do that? And I think you're probably saying the same thing this time. How did they do that?
Yeah, did they? Yeah.
I just didn't know whether 2007 was different, because I felt like the Australia in the quarterfinal was more of a challenge than they've faced so far in this tournament.
It was.
That was very specific, though. It was two players. They don't forget that was carnage at the scrum. Caused by Andrew Sheridan and Phil Vickery, that was a total collapse in one position.
Okay, boys. Well, I'll tell you what we're possibly planning on doing, or plans are in the pipeline at the moment, to have a semi-final preview coming out towards the end of the week. So I fly back into Paris on Thursday, so it might end up in your feed late Thursday, possibly on Friday, for you to listen to before that first semi-final.
Right, perfect.
But once we've had a little bit more build-up and we've let the dust settle on the quarterfinals, hopefully we'll get that to you later in the week. It means, gents, we can move on to the final thing, God or Goddess of the Week. I think there is a heap of options for us. The amount of times that we, particularly when we're in the studio back in London, that we get to this section, everyone's all of a sudden scratching their head, trying to think of, oh, who shall I select? I think there is so much to choose from. Would anyone like to kick us off for their God or Goddess of the Week?
Well, Ardie Survey would be the obvious one.
That's fine.
But I would put in also a big thumbs up for Muvaka yesterday. A performance by a hooker. Yeah, he was just absolutely magnificent. But I'd probably go Ardie Survey, because finally the rest of the team decided they would help him win a game, and that must be a great, great help for him mentally and physically.
I'm going to go for a player I'd never rated, as Richie Mwanga. I thought he had a tremendous game, a career game. Obviously, he was on the front foot. The way he created that try, I mean, what gas he showed. So Richie Mwanga of New Zealand for me, and I'm sorry, Richie, I never rated you.
Slotty?
Well, I suppose I should say Sam Kane, because I've already said he's my player of the weekend. Just to take it in a slightly different direction, when the game got slightly broken on Sunday night, I hadn't seen Matthew Jalibert's dancing feet like that. I mean, he was such an elusive ball carrier. I hadn't seen that before. It was kind of slightly throwback fly half play. I'll have him as my god for now.
Good one.
It's a good one. I was actually going to go Sam Kane as well, because I thought he was outstanding for a player that I know, as has kind of been referenced, has often been criticised, particularly amongst the New Zealand public. I thought he was absolutely brilliant and led from the front. And I think that comment by Peter Omani on that tour, of "you're just a poor man's Richie McCaw," or words to that effect, I think he had a point to prove, and I thought he was excellent. But in terms of also, I'm conscious that we've had quite a few All Blacks, I'll give it to a Springbok and the man we mentioned of Cheslin Kolbe. You look at moments, you look at a one-point win in a quarter-final against the home side and a charge-down conversion that we never see. Give it to Cheslin Kolbe.
Very good one. Very good.
Slotty, you're off to get the Eurostar?
Yeah, but I'll be back almost immediately.
Perfect.
You know, England in a semi-final, nowhere else to be, huh?
Absolutely.
Well, by public demand, you're back as well. Viewers and listeners and readers.
The public vote, it's like the X Factor.
They need you there.
Let's carry on. I'm liking this.
Okay.
Chris, you've also got a flight tonight.
Yes, I'm going to find a new airport. It's meant to be called Beauvais. I've never flown from it before. I think somebody's actually sold me a pub and it doesn't exist.
Is it
but I'll let
airport?
You know.
Okay, great. And Steve, you're staying out now for the duration of the
tournament.
Yes,
I'm going straight back to bed now.
Absolutely. And I'll be coming back on Thursday. Great to see you all. Just a little bit of in-house admin as well. A reminder that all episodes of How to Win the World Cup are available on the Ruck podcast feed. You can hear from Sean Fitzpatrick, Joel Stransky, John Eales, Conrad Smith, Lawrence Dallaglio, Francois Lowe and Fury Dupria about what it takes to win the World Cup. So make sure you get that. And then also The Game, which is the Times and Sunday Times' football podcast, is available every Monday and Tuesday as well. But as well as that, they've just released an England special all about Gareth Southgate. So you can go and check that out wherever you get your podcast from. This has been The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Follow or subscribe from wherever you get your podcast. We'll see you next time.